history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories just waiting to be told if we'll take the time to listen a little bit. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I am in Pueblo, Colorado at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum. Pretty impressive museum. Love the gift shop. There are some real doozies in there. I'm going to spend some time when we're done. And hopefully we're going to hear some pretty incredible stories from one of the volunteers here. And I don't know how many aircraft museums you can go to and find the guy that's helping you in the gift shop is 97 years old. But that's Bill Barrett's story. He's sticking to it. He's lived in Pueblo for 60 years now. And what made you decide at age 91, Bill, to volunteer at an aircraft museum?
Well, I was beginning to be a little bored staying at home, so I kind of looked around for something to do. I saw an ad in our local paper that they were needing help here at the museum, so I came out and talked to him, and I was hired to be a volunteer, and I've been here ever since.
And you spend most of your time in the gift shop,
I do, yes. I do not walk too well anymore, and there's a lot of walking to if you're a tour guide.
What are the big items in the gift shop that you see a lot of people snatching up?
We have a lot of toys for kids, a lot of airplanes, and a lot of our stuff goes to kids, especially if they're with Grandpa.
Yeah, and I bet they are. And I bet it's neat for them to talk to someone who's 97 years old but doesn't seem like it.
Yeah.
And you have two hangars worth of historic aircrafts here. Do you have a favorite? Is something that's on display at this museum?
Probably my favorite at the museum is the B-29 that we have here. We call it Peachy, and the reason it is called Peachy is that there was a young man from Pueblo that was a B-29 pilot. He had a sister he called Peachy. So when we got the aircraft here, we had to name it Peachy.
I guess you did, yeah. Does it look like the ones you saw in the Pacific during World War II?
Very much so.
And Pueblo has quite a history with World War II. This airstrip we're next to had some bombers flying off of it.
They trained the crews here for the B-24s, the B-29s, and the B-17s.
So the B-29 here is your favorite. Is there another one or two that you see a lot of people gravitating towards?
And different people like different planes. I like the A-26 real well. And my favorite plane during World War II was the P-38 Lightning.
Well, and you have a picture of yourself on the most famous P-38 Lightning that ever existed, and we're going to get that story from you before we're done here. But the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum is open 7 days a week. If you're lucky, you might run into Bill. What days are you here, Bill?
I'm on Wednesday, Saturday, and Sundays.
Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday. So plan your visit, Pueblo, Colorado, and come say hello to Bill, 97. He'll be 98 in November. Let's go back to your early days, though.
Okay.
Belleville, Kansas. What kind of place is that?
It's a small town in north central Kansas, just south of the Nebraska line. It's a farming community, not much industry there.
Did you grow up in a big family, small family?
No, I had two brothers older than I, and I still have one sister that's younger than I.
So what were those growing up years like for you?
You know, that's been a long time ago. And I don't remember an awful lot about my childhood.
You just don't want to tell me about the times you got in trouble? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I can't remember any of them.
Do you remember, Bill, having any ambitions, some hopes, some dreams, some, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this and this and this?
Not really. I just went with the flow.
Well, I guess you would have been out of high school a few years before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
That's
if you're
right.
97 now.
Yeah.
So what'd you do after high school?
I worked in the drugstore for a few years, and then I got a job as a drug salesman for a wholesale drug company in St. Joseph, Missouri. I traveled in north central Kansas and a small portion of Nebraska.
So you had a career going. You were moving on with life.
Right.
And you had a special someone in your life?
My girlfriend.
Lillian,
yeah.
How'd you two meet?
We knew each other in high school. I was a couple of years older than she. Actually, she worked in a little luncheonette there in town. I used to go over there and have a sandwich or something to eat once in a while and got acquainted with her and finally started going with her.
Yeah, so you're pretty sweet on her.
I was, yes.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
I was working at a drugstore that Sunday. When I got home, I didn't know anything about it at the store, but when I got home, the radio was on and was hearing about what had happened.
Was that pretty jarring?
Yes, it was.
Did you know where Pearl Harbor was?
Not exactly. I knew where Hawaii was, but I didn't know Pearl Harbor.
Had you ever even considered the prospect of war?
No.
Nothing?
No, I never did.
And now all of a sudden, the Japanese have attacked American territory.
Right.
So what'd you do about it?
The war started in December. In January, I went to Kansas City, Missouri, enlisted in the Army, signed some papers, talked to a number of people, and they sent me back home to quit my job and come back at a later date to be inducted.
Why'd you do that? Why did you want to get in the Army? You had a good job.
I just figured it had to do it.
Your country needed you.
Your country needed it.
And you didn't want to wait to be drafted?
I didn't want to be drafted, yeah. I don't know how soon I would have been drafted. At that time, they had drawings for the draft. Everybody had a number, and then every once in a while they'd have a draft and draw out the different numbers.
Did you have an expectation of what you might be doing in the Army?
I had no idea. They didn't ask me what I wanted to do. I just wound up in the Signal Corps, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, and a lot of people these days aren't familiar with the Signal Corps. Or if they do ever hear the Signal Corps, it's maybe they see a photograph from 70 years ago, and it says U.S. You know, Signal Corps at the bottom. So tell us about the Signal Corps.
They sent me from Kansas City to Jefferson Barracks in Missouri. I was just there for a few days. Then I went to Camp Crowder, Missouri, which was an Army Signal Corps training center. The Signal Corps was the Army's way of communicating. Mm-hmm. They did it by radio, telephone, telegraph, in person, carrier pigeon. I don't think we ever used that in where I was, but then, and they used motorcycles some and different types of ways to communicate.
But you probably also had to go through basic training too, right?
Basic training was more or less the some of the Signal Corps things that you had to do. I knew how to type because I took typing in high school. I tried to learn the Morse code, but I didn't have the ear for those dots and dashes. Then I got some cryptography training when he was there at Camp Crowder.
Cryptography. So tell us what cryptography is.
Cryptography is the encoding and decoding of messages. From our signal center, every message that went out, every message that came in had to be in code. It was our job to put it into code or decode it and deliver the message to the proper authority.
Did it take you a while to get a handle for that?
Not too much. We had a machine that did a lot of it.
What was that machine called?
It was called SIGABA, S-I-G-A-B-A.
How big was it?
About the size of a teletype machine.
Today, people carry a little machine around in their hand called a smartphone that can outcompute just about anything, but you know, spatially, how much space did that take up?
Probably as big as your laptop.
All right.
Yeah, only it was complete, you know, it didn't have a frame that came up, or this that came up.
Big and thick and kind of heavy?
Yeah, it was. Oh, yeah, real heavy. Yeah.
So what could that machine do?
It encoded and decoded the machines for us.
So you could type in a message in plain English?
Right.
And it would turn it into a code?
Into a code. The way we got that code, the machine had 10 wheels on it.
Uh-huh.
And you had to set those wheels. The first five wheels we set every day at the same. The wheels had the 26 letters, the alphabet on it, each wheel. And then each morning or at midnight, you had to set those five wheels at a certain number or letters.
Right.
That was given to us by a book we had that told us how to set it. And then on every message, the first 10 digits on the message that came in told us where to set the second wheel.
Okay.
And then you just typed your message and it either decoded or encoded.
So if you get one of those wheels off by one, the whole thing doesn't make any sense.
I don't know.
You never found out?
I never found out about that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So if everything has to be encoded, it means that the nature of these messages that are being transmitted must be fairly sensitive.
We had several different types of messages. We had the routine messages. We had priority messages. We had secret and top secret. But there was five different classifications of messages.
Did you feel a sense of responsibility or maybe even pressure to not mess this up?
Well, probably yes. I was the non-commissioned officer in charge of the Signal Center. After I made staff sergeant, they promoted me to in charge of the Signal Center. I didn't do a lot of coding and decoding after that. I more or less had to see that everything got done.
And were you hoping to head overseas, or would you have been just fine staying stateside?
I figured I would be sent overseas, yes.
And you went over pretty early.
Yes, I did. 6 months after I was in the service, I was sent overseas. September 1st.
September 1st, 1942.
We left the States.
Where'd you go?
Well, I tell people that I had a 29-day all-expense-paid cruise to Brisbane, Australia from San Francisco with a 3-day stopover in the Fiji Islands.
Sounds pretty luxurious, Bill.
Well, accommodations weren't like they are today on a cruise.
Had you ever been at sea before?
No, I had not.
I was going to say, young guy from Kansas, maybe a creek or a river is about as big as it gets.
I've been in a small boat.
Uh-huh.
Going fishing or something.
So you spend a month on a big old ship with
right.
a bunch of guys.
Yeah, right.
What was that like?
Very crowded. The food wasn't that great. Accommodations weren't that great. Down in the hold, there were about 4 decks of bunks that mm-hmm. you had to sleep in. And it was hot and sticky down there. We would sleep out on deck if the weather was decent and if you could find a spot to...
if nobody else beat you to
beat
it.
Beat you
huh?
to it, yeah.
How about submarines? Was there a concern that you guys would be in danger?
I think there was because... when you're going overseas during the wartime, you zigzag.
Yeah.
And that's for submarine protection. And it takes longer going over than it does coming back when we came back because of the zigzag.
So you get to Australia.
Right.
And what's next?
Got off the ship. They took us up to a little town called Ipswich, Australia, where there was an army air base called Amberley Field. And I understand, I've talked to some people from Australia, Amberley Field is still there.
How about that?
Yeah. We spent about 3 months there, and we didn't do a lot. They had us out in the field about a half a mile away from the main camp, and we had to walk down there to our meals and stuff. We didn't do any communication until we got to New Guinea.
You know, and I'm always struck by this aspect of you guys who lived through this time, because we have the benefit of hindsight now. We can tell you, hey, December 7th, 1941 to mid-August 1945. That was World War II for America. But when you get over there in late 1942, how long did you think this was going to last? I mean, do you have any idea how long you're going to be out there?
I had no idea.
Did you think you might be in danger?
No.
No? Even though...
Not in our conditions, no. We had a lot of air raids, and that was all. I wasn't in a combat unit, and there wasn't any fighting close by. But we did have several air raids, and we actually lost some people in our unit in air raids.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's dangerous. Japanese bombers can kill you.
Yeah, that's true.
And before I get further with your experience in the Pacific, what about Lillian? What'd you say to her when you said goodbye?
I don't know.
Did you think you were going to come back and see her again?
Well... You never know. At that time, I didn't know what I was going to be in.
Mm-hmm.
However, when I was in Camp Crowder, my grandmother Barrett passed away, and I didn't get a 3-day pass to go home to her funeral. It took me a day to get there. So right after the funeral, I had to go back to Kansas City, and then the next morning catch a train back to Camp Crowder. She did go back to Kansas City with me. She had a sister that lived in Kansas City. So we stayed there that night, and the next morning I had to say goodbye and never saw her again until November 45.
Wow. Did you get a few letters from her during that time?
I got a lot of letters from her, an awful lot of letters. I was unable to keep them. I had no way to do that, but she kept every letter that I wrote to her.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's how I wrote this, is from those letters.
You've got some of those letters. You put personal history together a few
right.
years ago.
Right.
While we're on that topic, here you are on the other side of the world from Kansas. What did it mean to you to get those letters from your girl?
I meant an awful lot to get them from my girl and my family also. My folks wrote quite often. My sister wrote quite often. I didn't hear too much from my brothers, for they were both in the service also.
Yeah, where did they end up?
One of them was in infantry in France. My other one was in Germany, and he was in intelligence some way. He never did talk too much about it.
But all three of you came home?
All three of us came home. My oldest brother was in Normandy about 3 or 4 days after they invaded it. He did get injured and got some shrapnel in his leg. They sent him back to a hospital and for a few days and then right back to the front.
Well, your family certainly made its contribution. Without question. So for you, you said 3 months there at Ipswich?
Then up to Port Moresby, New Guinea.
And he would spend the next year and a half there with plenty of memorable moments over that time span. We'll hear about that when we come back. 97-year-old Bill Barrett of Pueblo, Colorado is our guest today. If you don't make it to Pueblo to meet him in person at the Air Museum where he volunteers 3 days a week, you can at least check out the photos and video online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.